Can we just go ahead and get started then?
Yeah.
All right, well, I'll just go ahead and get started. My name is Edwin Shank. My Lakota name is Sha'ag Yamani. It means he walks strong. And my mom was praying, and she said that the thought crossed her mind that he walks strong in his faith. Being a strong Christian was what she was thinking. And so then when I graduated from college, she gave me a name, Sha'ag Yamani, and we had a ceremony and at the powwow over in Fort Pierce, South Dakota, the annual powwow over there. And so that's the name she gave me, so look out, because I walk strong. I'm a member of the Lac-Vieux Désert Ojibwe band of Lake Superior Ojibwe Indians. It's up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, on the border between Michigan and Wisconsin. So it's basically northern Wisconsin. It's a great little place. Probably about 600 members there. Really small tribe, and everybody knows each other very well. It's kind of typical in tribes, I think. Also, like I said before, I have a Lakota name because my mom is Lakota, which means I'm Lakota too. So I'm Cheyenne River Lakota as well, although that's not my tribal affiliation. That's we can only have one; can't be like dual citizens. BIA doesn't like that; they like to keep track of us. But culturally, I'd say that I'm more Sioux than Ojibwe. I received my Master of Arts degree from Luther Seminary in Old Testament Studies. Actually, just back in May. Before that, I was a student at North Central University in Biblical Studies, and I finished there in 2010 with my Bachelor of Arts degree in Biblical Studies. And I'm actually now the director of the library over at North Central as of July of this year, and working on a library degree at St. Catherine University as well. So I guess by way of introducing the topic of this workshop, I think it'd be appropriate to say that what is at stake in our thinking about the United States colonization of indigenous peoples and our lands are a number of issues that range in significance from the seemingly mundane to the most important issues, such as whether tribal governments can prosecute non-members in instances of domestic violence against tribal members, or whether how much and to which tribes' land should be returned by the United States government. So there are some really serious issues that are at stake in our thinking about legal justifications, and particularly when I get to it here is how the Old Testament functions in U.S. legal thinking attitudes towards Native Americans. The issues are pervasive, and once you have been made aware of the basic history and undergirding ideologies of American imperialism, the vestiges of our horrible past remain around every corner. For example, the building that houses the T.J. Jones Library, where I work every day, was originally built in the early 20th century as the Tortolot Memorial Deaconess Home. The Deaconess Home was a house for nurses that worked in the hospital. That shared the same block. Tortolot was a wealthy Minneapolis landowner who earned his wealth by serving as an army surgeon for the 7th Cavalry. As the descendant of survivors of the Wounded Knee Massacre, where the 7th Cavalry unleashed fully automatic weapons on my ancestors, I find it very ironic to be working in a building that was erected by the wealth and in memorial of Tortolot. Even our most beloved spaces appear to be mired in colonialism. Such being the case, it is very important for the work of this conference to dismantle systems of colonial power, to move forward, and for us to take it with us even into our most beloved and perhaps sacred places, that is, our churches, and to grapple with the implications of our learning and with our faith together with our communities. So as a part of the description for this workshop, I mentioned the work of Stephen Newcomb in his relatively recent 2008 work, Pagans in the Promised Land, Decoding the Doctrine of Christian Discovery. It's important to note at the outset that Newcomb's work is primarily work of legal scholarship. I'm just going to pass this around, starting with Jim. Who's already read it, of course. So it's important to note at the outset that Newcomb's work is primarily a work of legal scholarship, and one that engages the cutting edge of the increasingly significant field of cognitive science among many disciplines. Many disciplines are reaching for cognitive science for a deeper understanding of human thinking, which has implications for studies like literature and theology and biblical studies and legal studies, and so that's what he's doing. So I'm not a legal theorist, nor am I a cognitive scientist. My training is in Old Testament history, translation, and interpretation. Therefore, this workshop will deal with the places where Newcomb's important work intersects with the Old Testament, and particularly my thesis, which dealt with the biblical representations of Canaanites in the Old Testament from Genesis to Joshua. So what I'm going to be doing is what's going to happen is I'm going to be talking a lot about the Old Testament, and maybe at times you might be thinking, wow, how is this related to colonialism? But it's analogous in a huge way, and Newcomb talks about that in two of his chapters in the book that I passed around there. So, in speaking of the cognitive models that undergird the doctrine of discovery, Stephen Newcomb writes the following. When forms of reasoning found in the Old Testament narrative are used to reason about American Indian lands, the result is that Indian lands metaphorically become conceptualized from the viewpoint of the United States as the promised land of the chosen people of the United States. And real important here, a similar metaphorical mapping deflects attention away from any specific acknowledgement of Indian people. And so I'm going to add Canaanites, because he makes a really interesting note about this. Thereby drawing attention away from the question of the rightfulness of taking the land away from those who are already in possession of it. So we're doing some work here, connecting the doctrine of discovery to Old Testament thinking. Elsewhere, Newcomb writes that Judge Marshall's employment of such terms as pagans and heathens, but especially the phrase ultimate title, serves as analogies to the Old Testament models of thinking about conquest. And these are sufficient to demonstrate Old Testament-like thinking of the doctrine of discovery. So I'll just say that again because I kind of stammered through it. Elsewhere, Newcomb writes that Judge Marshall's employment of the terms pagans and heathens, but especially the phrase ultimate title, serves as analogies to Old Testament models of thinking about conquest, and are sufficient to demonstrate the Old Testament-like thinking of the doctrine of discovery. So I'm going to say that insofar as the phrases pagans and heathens are coterminous with Canaanites, and ultimate title with the promise of land in the Old Testament to Abraham, I think Newcomb is correct. And much of the United States' claim to lands and government of those lands is tied to legal justifications and ideologies inherited from Christendom and promoted by an ostensibly secular legal institution. So that's a problem, right? And I think that that's something that gets really lost when people don't have that knowledge. But the sort of theological underpinnings of the secular state's right to govern territory is essentially what Newcomb is saying is kind of odd. So the United States can pretend like it's secular now, but all the justifications for its rights to territories all come out of theological, religious, Christian settings. That's a problem for Christianity, too. Or for people who care about the gospel, and for people who care about Christ and the saving message, especially among Native Americans. What is compelling about Newcomb's work is that he illustrates the basic problem of a type of thinking that impedes addressing the human objects of conquest. Let me say that again. What is compelling about Newcomb's work is that he illuminates the basic problem of a type of thinking that impedes addressing the human objects of conquest. In our case, Native Americans, and in the Old Testament case, the Canaanites. This was a basic observation of mine as I was reading for my thesis, And it was what compelled me to begin my research by asking the simple question, who were the Canaanites? Very simple. Who were they? It turns out the answer is not so simple, and that there is not a lot of research on the Canaanites of the Bible that does not treat the project under the impression that they are gaining a deeper understanding of ancient Israel. So what I'm trying to say is that most of the scholarship on Canaanites is actually focused on Israel. There's very little that's like, who are the Canaanites in their own terms? So my thesis project seemed broken from the start, but I went for it anyways. How Canaanites come out of the Old Testament is important for this conversation because of Newcomb's thesis that U.S. legal attitudes towards Native Americans are analogous to Old Testament attitudes towards Canaanites. So they function as an analogy. So Newcomb's saying, here's how the Old Testament is sort of functioning as an ideological foundation for the doctrine of discovery. And so where I can connect with it as an Old Testament scholar is I can say, well, here's what that Old Testament thinking looks like as it sort of condescends towards Canaanites. And so by analogy, the way the Old Testament treats Canaanites is sort of the same attitudes that are embodied in U.S. legal attitudes towards Native Americans, if Newcomb is right. And I think he is. So the thesis I came up with is as follows. Like humans are the image of God in Genesis, the Canaanites are images of chaos throughout the narrative from their first appearance in Genesis to the book end of the book of Judges. That was the sort of frame of my thesis. I went from Genesis to Judges, looking at how Canaanites are represented in the Bible. So like humans are the images of God in Genesis, the Canaanites are images of chaos throughout the narrative from their first appearance in Genesis to the end of the book of Judges. In the historical religious sphere, they symbolized cosmic corruption, portals of disorder bringing religious and political dysfunction, family dysfunction, disease and destruction via their physical presence. In the text, they symbolize the antediluvian chaos, means the pre-flood chaos, before God destroyed the world by flood. In the text, they symbolize this pre-flood chaos, which was cleansed by the floodwaters of God. But in the experience of ancient Israel, Canaanites embody these attributes as the first cause in the physics of chaos. So the text, as far as the text of the Bible and the narrative unfolds, the world's really sinful, and the sons of God are taking daughters of men, and this is a problem. So God says, I'm going to fix this by destroying everything, and you, Noah, you're cool, we'll save you, and you'll repopulate the earth. What happens is, after the earth begins to be repopulated, or after the floodwaters recede, Noah plants a vineyard and makes wine, right? So there's a problem with wine too, right? but he was the first one, so you know he made all the mistakes with it, so we don't have to. But then something weird happens. Something weird happens with his son Ham, who sees his nakedness. And there are these really, really sexual overtones to the passage. But regardless of what the seeing of the nakedness was, Canaan becomes cursed. And so what you have is a narrative construction that has a pre-flood, sinful, sexually permissive world. Somehow gods and humans are getting it on. God destroys that. And then with Noah's family, you have this sexual deviance reemerging with the person, and the curse then gets ascribed to Canaan, so that Canaan bears the mark of this world that God had wanted to destroy. Canaan is, and so that's the text world of the text. And so in the ancient religious setting, you are looking at people around you who bear the designation Canaanite, and looking at them as bearers of that sexual deviance, bearers of that chaos, bearers of that whatever strike it was that God wanted to destroy from the earth. That's how you're looking at a Canaanite. So, in seeking a thick description of how the Canaanite, and I'll say if that's the case, that it also makes sense that the United States and its legal attitudes towards Native Americans looks at Native Americans in much similar fashion. And this is where like the rhetoric of civilization becomes real apparent. Like, you know, we're savages and uncivilized, and we're forces of chaos, essentially. We are threats to the success of the state in whatever condition we were in previously, to the U.S. conquest. But anyways, in seeking a thick description of how the Canaanites are depicted in the first seven books of the Old Testament, the reader will take note of the overwhelmingly negative portrayal of these peoples in the text. Canaan is the son of Ham, infamous for viewing the nakedness of his own father. For Ham's misdeed, Noah curses Canaan, for whatever reason, and his descendants are doomed to be slaves to the descendants of Ham's brothers, Shem and Japheth. This is the first mention of Canaan in the Bible, and it really sets the tone for their discourse on Canaanites as it anticipates. The passage represents a very important piece of the narrative symbolism and will be... I already discussed it, so I won't go back. If one could draft a synopsis, though, of how the text depicts Canaanites in the Pentateuch and the conquest narratives, it would be this. And this is a bit long, and maybe it's just going to emphasize how overwhelmingly negatively Canaanites are portrayed in the Old Testament. The Canaanites are fated to complete dispossession and total annihilation, which they deserve, since they are the embodiment of chaos on earth. Canaanites are depicted as slaves. They are depicted as in fear of Yahweh and Israel. Yahweh sends terror, Amati, my terror, to drive them out of their land in Exodus 23:27. They are destined for destruction. Yahweh will erase them from the land, which vomits, if Hebrews is key, vomits them out. Nothing that breathes in their towns is to be spared in conquest. Their culture and religion are to be destroyed as well. Israel is not to follow their ways. The verse Leviticus, or in Exodus, says, "You shall not do as they do, or imitate their ways," and I won't read the Hebrew. They are sexual reprobates committing illicit intercourse with their mothers and stepmothers, their sisters and stepsisters, their granddaughters, daughters-in-law, and aunts, a woman and her daughter, and with women and with women who are sisters, and the wives of their kin, they commit menstrual intercourse, and same-sex male intercourse, and bestiality. They are also desirous of and do commit rape. Canaanites sacrifice their children to Molech. They defile themselves and defile the land. They turn to mediums and wizards and curse their fathers and mothers. They are fodder for Israelite war training and judges. Their cities are devoid of the righteous, Genesis 19, and it is out of Sodom and Gomorrah, Moses says, that grow the vines which yield poisonous grapes. They are set apart for cherem, which is ritual destruction, and their condition is contagious, a snare if they are not completely removed. Their status as cherem, as devoted to ritual destruction, is also communicable. They are dispossessed on account of their wickedness. It is assumed that they must be fought, and yet by the end of Judges, they remain in the land. So while these biblical attitudes towards Canaanites are not reflected precisely in the analogies to U.S. legal positioning toward Native Americans in every instance, they do embody and describe well the general trajectory of thinking about inferior, savage, and uncivilized peoples, that is, indigenous peoples. So what I'm saying is that Native Americans didn't do everything the Canaanites are described as doing. And that was a real problem I had when I was going through my thesis, because I, you know, generally read with the kind of identifying with Canaanites being the object of conquest and, you know, sort of have some sympathy towards Canaanites until you get to Leviticus 17. There's like some bizarre sexual stuff going on. I'm like, okay, that's not us. Like, you know, we're not down with that. So anyways, that's all I'm saying there. There are differences, but in general, the general trajectory of condescending towards savage and uncivilized people is embodied in this these descriptions. Once you're made aware of this, say, even a seemingly innocent word like civilization begins to imply savagery, and you must balk at its appearance in writing or utterance in speech, or at least, you know, have it like queued up for like, oh, someone's talking about civilization. Like, as a Native American, I hear the word civilization and I think like, oh, as opposed to savagery, or as opposed to being uncivilized or something like that. So essential to my thesis was a proper understanding. I'm trying to watch the time here. Essential to my thesis was a proper understanding of the chaos associated with Canaanites and the subsequent ordering of that chaos by Israel, which took the form of conquest. If humans were the image of God, the Canaanites were images corrupted. In the religious sphere, they symbolized cosmic chaos, portals of disorder bringing via their physical presence religious and political dysfunction, disease, and destruction. They embody these attributes as a first cause in the physics of chaos. The idea of Canaanites as agents of disorder runs deep throughout the Old Testament, so I refer to this as a physics of chaos. Physical in the sense of bodies, like physicality and organs and body parts and stuff. Physical in the sense of bodies, and physics in the sense of bodies in motion, right? So these are people with bodies who are embodied, and they're also bringing things into being through their presence, namely that chaos I was talking about before. I come to this description based on the ancient perception of image, that is, the image of God, but not in the modern linguistic sense of sign and signified, you know, like you say phone, so like phone is the sign, and this is this what's signified, cell phone. I come to the description on the base of rather than sight and signified, it is important to understand that the image was a vehicle of presence in the ancient world. So this concept has some important implications for considering how Canaanites functioned as symbols in the textual world, as well as the historical religious setting. So that's what I was talking about before. So like in the text, they kind of bear this mark. They bring this chaos. And so when you leave temple, you look at Canaanites in a different way. So I picked some major representative texts for doing my thesis, and Genesis, which I already talked about a little bit, was one of the big ones. Next was Leviticus 18 and 20. And forgive me, I think I said Leviticus 17 earlier, I meant 18 and 20. But in these passages, this is the organizing of family chaos associated with Canaanites. And in the ancient world, the family was organized by, actually it is very tribal, to be frank. And there was extended family units that lived together in one setting. So you'd have mother and father, children and their families, and their children, sort of all living together and composing the, you know, basic political unit of ancient Israel or Canaan or whatever it was. So it's very native, you know, like I look at that family construction and way of dealing with issues, and I identify with Israelites then as a Native American, which is kind of, it made the whole thesis really take on a interesting, like, tension, you know, to identify with certain things and to not identify with, it was just a great thing to explore. But essentially, in these passages, you get all the bizarre sexual acts that are prohibited and communicated to the head of the household, which was then responsible for maintaining order and preserving these designations so that the son of a father isn't sleeping with his father's wife, or something like that. It was the responsibility of the man to do that. And so I started to look at this, and the beginning of these passages say, do not be like the Egyptians, do not be like the Canaanites. Do not allow, and then the text goes into all of these prohibitions, like, do not sleep with your mother, don't sacrifice your children to Molech, you know. And so then there's this idea of chaos there that is the potential, has the potential to exist within a family setting, and there's a person set up over that family who is responsible for ordering that chaos. So there's the chaos and the order theme again. And then in Joshua 6 was the next big one that I didn't have enough time to look into. It was very interesting. The concept of the harem, as I mentioned before, was a essentially religious ideology undergirding warfare. So when a harem was commanded, there would be specific rules, and the warfare was to be carried out in a very ritualistic manner. So that's why you have these texts like for instance, in Deuteronomy, I forget the passage now, I think it's Deuteronomy 7, but you have a text that says something like, devote their cities to destruction, and that's how it gets translated into English, that verb, harem. Devote their cities to destruction, but I would prefer to translate it, ritually devote their cities to destruction. So like, cleanse them, order them. And here are the instructions. Do not let anything that breathes survive. Everything must be annihilated. Also, for example, in Joshua 6 and 7 here, you have the command given, the designation given to certain spoils of war, like the gold and the silver is cherem, which means it has some type of ritual use that's ascribed to it, which is also a very Native American concept, that once like a thing is designated for use, like stones in a sweat lodge, you can't just like call off the sweat lodge. You can't just like, you know, not use those stones for that purpose because they've been designated. And so like this it's just more of that interesting tension going on. The harem can be posited as an ordering of sacred space as well. So Canaanites, represented in Joshua 6 as the residents of Jericho, symbolize the chaos of the primordial earth in Genesis 1. The harem warfare is depicted as a creative action insofar as it brings about order, of course, on the terms of the society that engages in this type of warfare. So it's the order that we want, and we're going to create it for us. Stern argues, this is a scholar talking who did a like huge study on just this one word for his doctoral dissertation at the University of Michigan. But he argues for Joshua 6 as an act of creation. So this is what he writes. In this context of Joshua 6, and thinking about this type of warfare as a creative act, the war harem fit exactly, since according to our understanding, it represented purposeful destruction of the forces of chaos in order to bring about world order. He builds this statement on the analysis of Walter Brueggemann and Mircea Eliade, linking creation as restoration of land, that's what Brueggemann says, and religion's tendency to view settlement of new territories as a cosmogonic event, right? It's like a cosmic event, settling new territories. This is why we have stars and stars on our flag, right? In the United States, it makes sense. Of particular interest to the current project, though, that being my thesis, is Stern's assessment that the ancient concept of harem, as expressed in an ancient inscription, a non-Israelite inscription that uses the same word, it basically articulates the struggle of a people to overcome the forces of chaos and to establish world order, including the moral order of the universe. So, given the above analysis, I think Stern is correct in that, you know, warfare is to bring about order, as any society can define it. So, I guess on a last note here before I jump into discussion, I'll say that all these texts have primarily to do with the ordering of chaos. Between Leviticus 20 and Joshua 6, the creation account of Genesis 1 can function as an intermediary connecting the basic themes in each. As a matter of analogy, in that both Leviticus and Joshua displace the Canaanite as the antithesis of their creating activity, meaning Canaanites are opposing the creating action. Whether through being separated from or sacrificially destroying, Canaanites may be seen as the very chaos which Elohim subdues to create the sacral order articulated in Genesis 1. Thus we have in the passage of Genesis 1, not creatio ex nihilo, nor creatio ex Deo, creation out of nothing or creation out of God. What we have is creatio ex pagano, creation out of the pagan, indeed out of the chaos that is designated as Canaan. So that's my thesis in a nutshell, and I think insofar as Newcomb is correct in saying that the doctrine of discovery employs an Old Testament attitude of thinking towards Canaanites as it addresses Native Americans, then you know this is really relevant, and as Christians or people grappling with faith in a real way, I think it's important to understand deeper some of the ancient attitudes towards Canaanites. So I don't have any guided questions or anything like that, but I'm just... Anybody want to react?
I'd like to jump in with a question, maybe.
Yeah.
As I've read and studied the Old Testament, particularly Genesis to Joshua, the sort of core part of the Deuteronomistic history. Its function for the House of David was a rhetorical. It was a rhetorical play for power for the House of David. The way the Canaanites are portrayed is part of the House of David's claim to power. Is that this historical, we subdued the land and claimed and built this thing, and that's our power. That's why you should trust us against the Babylonians and the Egyptians and the Assyrians, because of this historical basis that we're claiming there. And that, you know, this order chaos theme is part of that, saying, you know, we want the union of the northern and southern kingdoms. We want you trust the House of David because this order is Yahweh's way. This is God's way against the chaos that lurks outside. So I wonder, in your study, looking at the way that the Old Testament portrays Canaanites, if you distinguish between sort of the polemic, in other words, the propaganda of the New Testament, the propaganda of the Old Testament and the historical events. In other words, there probably was no literal conquest of Canaan, but that we're reading sort of like ancient political propaganda, much as there was no actual divine mandate for American expansion westward, but Manifest Destiny was political propaganda for America in order to fuel that. Do you see the distinction between what I'm trying to talk about, the question about the distinction between the actual historical, like, events and historical relation between Israelites and Canaanites versus the sort of political propaganda and the social narrative that's concocted about it?
I think what you just described constitutes one of the biggest tragedies for anybody who knows about American history and knows about Old Testament history. Because essentially what you're saying is you have a fabricated conquest that was put together as political rhetoric to unite tribes into the Davidic kingdom. So this never happened. It was fake, but it did happen in real life to Native Americans.
Right.
And it fueled that ideology westward expansion because of the notion of a divine command. So I do see the distinction between what you're talking about. I have not encountered anybody who is wrestling with that distinction, but I've wrestled a little bit with it and have decided that is really tragic.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, we took something that was a myth, a fake, and made it real. In the most horrific way possible.
Basically.
Wasn't that the premise of the Spanish Inquisition as well? Conquest.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about the Spanish Inquisition, so I'm sorry, but...
Well, nobody expects it.
For me, that would just answer some questions of how can you have this dichotomy of God in the Old Testament, you know, wanting to kill and destroy, you know, and even David finally in the Psalms talking about killing babies, you know, and then here we have Jesus coming, and he has a whole totally different tone of, you know, loving your enemies. Well, if these were enemies of God, then how can we have God come again and say, well, I'm telling you, you're supposed to love your enemies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting what you mentioned, that if it's not a literal historical happening, or was it just a construct of a story? You know, I mean, it's interesting. I wonder what a Jewish person would think of them stories. Would they look at it as just literal stories, or would they look at it as stories to be told as propaganda?
I think there's just as much diversity in Jewish circles as there are in Christian circles.
Yep.
When it comes to that question.
Looking for some advice here, because when I was living in Oak Grove, I got a knock at the door. Open it up, there's these two Indians in suit and tie, and they say, "Hello, we're with the Church of Latter-day Saints." How should I have responded?
I don't know.
Oh, I said, come on in.
Come on in. Yeah. You know the...
I said, come on in, because I knew it was going to get interesting.
I think the top official for the LDS is actually Native American. Mm-hmm. Who used to have some important post in Indian affairs in Washington. But yeah, I mean that's definitely something to look into more, you know, the Latter-day Saints and the relationship with Native Americans. Yeah, so maybe we fare better with them because, you know, we were the lost tribes of Israel and not the Canaanites. Sorry, go ahead.
I think just the concept, it came up with the Spanish Inquisition, the concept of myth and reality is really interesting because I just was taking this medieval Spanish literature class and some of the oldest examples of Spanish literature actually have a wide amount of perspectives regarding the Moors, for example. There's one example of a story of a Spanish knight that gets captured by the Moors, and the Moorish captain says, "Okay, you're here. What if I was in your country? What hospitality would you show me?" And the Spanish guy is like, "Well, if you'd convert, you're welcome. If not, I'd kill you." So then the Moorish captain is like, "Fair enough. Convert to Islam and you're welcome. If not, I'll kill you." And so then he decides not to convert and gets killed. But there's a lot of the really like equal perspective, a lot of human perspective. One of the like heroes of Spain had really good Moorish friends, sometimes worked for the Moors. And those are like their oldest like myths and legends that have passed down through their oral tradition. And it's surprising to me because if in the oral tradition these things were preserved, where then comes the amount of like just blind hatred that could fuel the Inquisition? I just think it's an interesting question to me, and I haven't figured it out yet.
So, first of all, thank you for your presentation and your research. So, my question is, even if we remove this arbitrary, however real, association with Canaanites and Native Americans, even if we, apart from that, the conquest narrative as found through Deuteronomy, Leviticus, Judges, Joshua, that's still really troubling. Mm-hmm. Even if we're willing to say it's essentially mythology, mm-hmm. yet someone creates a mythology about that, and that's very troubling. The language of it mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. troubling. Kill everything that breathes. Mm-hmm. Okay. What, and we know, hermeneutics has evolved to its present state pretty much completely absent with a native indigenous voice in that. Mm-hmm. Now, you've done this research. You wrote a thesis on it. What is your hope that as a native individual you can bring to the hermeneutics that are employed that bring us to this point? What, like, how do you envision things being different if natives are consulted as we look at conquest narratives in Canaan?
Well, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is that I think as an American Indian who also loves the Lord and Jesus, and you know, I'm not a cradle Christian, I converted,
I was converted by the power of God at a church camp in Wisconsin. So this is real to me, is what I'm saying. I hope that Native Americans and other oppressed peoples, Palestinian Christians, reading these texts, will be able to bring something good to the greater community. Something real, you know. This tries your faith, you know, when you look at this stuff. It's hard. It's not like all the feel-good gospel stories, you know. It's not Sunday school. But it's a big question that Native Americans are asking themselves. It's a big question that probably Palestinian Christians are now asking themselves. You know, what? Who are the chosen people? And who are, you know, all these ideologies are there, and how do I wrestle with that with my faith? And I maybe don't have a great answer for that right now, because it is so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we do have a unique perspective to be heard among Christians in general.
I have a kind of a follow-up question to what Jinbear asked.
Yeah.
Historicity is one issue, and canonicity is another.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there is a way that even if we aren't, even if we don't grant historicity to certain events in the Bible, that for those of us who take the authority of the Word of God seriously, that it nevertheless has authority. Like Jesus teaches parables, and those are, you know, they're not historical. Like a woman, did a woman actually search all around her house for a coin? But it has authority. There's a lesson there that has authority in our lives. So, whether the conquests are historical or not, how do we as Christians navigate the canonicity or the authoritative nature? What authoritative teaching do we draw from that? The conservative way is to read it literalistically, right? And then to apply very dangerous lessons like, oh, these people are Canaanites, right? Or one-to-one kind of a thing. These are all black people are the descendants of Ham and Canaan, so they deserve to be enslaved. That's kind of a more conservative move. And then the liberal move is to say, oh, this is so horrible, so this just mythology is not canonical at all. So then you can pick and choose which parts of the Bible are canonical, and then that seems like a Marcion move, where this is canon and this is not. So there's very, very serious pitfalls in the liberal direction and the conservative direction. How do you, as an American Indian, struggle with canonicity of the scriptures, especially the conquest narratives?
And I just had a thought. I was just thinking about what you're saying. In, you know, the Europeans came here, but some of the same things that they did, we did. Like you think of the Ojibwe and the Lakota. And we were warlike, so we fought against each other. That's history. And we captured women or children from another tribe and vice versa. And they became part of the tribe, whatever tribe, where the Lakota or Ojibwe. And then it's interesting that the pastor mentioned the African American. Then you talk to, because I have friends who are Cherokee, and then when some of the slaves were on the run heading north, they were adopted into the Cherokee tribe, but some of them became their slaves of the Cherokee, and that's part of history. And so some of the things that we're looking at with that have happened to us in the conquest of the land, well, we did some of them same things because our fallen nature, you know? You wouldn't think that we would, like the Cherokee, make them our slaves, and we wouldn't think that, but we did some of the same things that as Canaanites did with our own people, you know? Just different tribes, so that's just kind of a thought that I was thinking.
Yeah.
My thought goes to was it before or after the discovery? Was the taking of Dakota women and children and whatever and adopting them in the tribe, and vice versa, or Cherokees enslaving blacks. Was that a learned behavior, or was that our regular culture? Was that already part of our culture? Yeah, and what's happening here in the last couple of days for me is you're rocking my whole foundation of definitions of history. Be careful. Be careful when you use the word history, because what is history? What is history? So you look at history, you say, well, yeah, okay, well, history says what history says. And then you can apply it to us, as my brother down here just did. But you say, now I got to say, because I love history, I have to say, was that the way things were before history? And there is no answer to that. I've heard a lot of oral history. My brother here and I were talking about that, and my understanding, that's the way as we received the word in the Old Testament, that was all oral history that was eventually written down. Mm-hmm. But these, as my brother said, these little marks on a piece of paper. And now I'm really confused as a whole man. That's not good.
I was thinking what you said, whether that was a learned behavior. Then if you go all the way back to the oral to the oral account, you know, how it was passed down to Moses, uh-huh. and Moses yeah. wrote the Pentateuch. Well, he says Cain killed Abel. Uh-huh. Where did he learn that? Because there was no killing that we know of orally that was recorded until that time. And so where did he learn that, unless it was his fallen nature that caused him? So anyways, that's just
for the sake of argument, though, I would say it was documented that it happened. I mean, the question arises, where did he come with that? Was that a learned behavior? And then ours isn't documented until history says, well, we went to the Cherokees and we found they had slaves. And so my question is, was that part of the Cherokee culture and heritage? Was the Ojibwe people taking people from the Dakota people and vice versa? Was that a shared cultural thing? Or was it something we learned? And there's no way we can sort of, I approach it cautiously, we can sort of say, well, it's written down. It's written down in Genesis. The brother killed the other brother.
Can I just say there's quite a bit of evidence that was learned behavior from European colonists, and we could go through a lot of books
right.
that document that. But I would love to hear Edward's response
right.
to my
just,
question about
right. yes,
canonicity.
You said that there's like the, you guys are like tapping into a huge debate. I know that exists in psychology. Whether,
but I love it.
But whether you know behaviors are innate or learned, and certainly humanity has a fallen nature, and I'm not going to say that whether or not Cherokees owned slaves before Europeans came and gave them as gifts, you know, to Cherokee, that they weren't capable of it, because we certainly were, and I don't like to think as an American Indian, I don't like to do anything but romanticize about my past, you know, but seriously, like, you know, we were not perfect, we're not like, the noble savage is the phrase that's used, and I think that we're very ignoble in some things as well, just like anybody else, we're humans.
So I don't want to go that way. And I'll even say that I heard in a documentary, so the knowledge is a little bit suspect. But at the before the Battle of Wounded Knee, Battle of Little Bighorn, Sitting Bull had a vision of victory, of white men and horses falling from the sky. And the one thing that he told the tribes who were united there, he said, one thing you cannot do is you cannot take any of their clothes, any of their weapons, anything that they own, because it'll be a death curse to you. Mm. And that thought, you see it again and again in the Israelite war harem. Mm. Don't take this and that. Don't take this because it'll be a curse to you. So like even Native American, even the Sioux, had this notion of like sacredness in warfare. And I think in the modern industrial age, where you have people who can, you know, unload 1,000 rounds of, you know, ammo in the course of a few seconds, it changes the way you view warfare. It's much different. But to get back to your question, it really is hard, you know. And I don't have a very good solution to the fact that these are here, these types of narratives are here in the canon. But I do acknowledge that, you know, that the Bible is an authority of some kind, like the authority for faith. And so I'm always conscious of what impact my reading and research is having on my faith. And one of the things that I've realized is that, and this is probably why my mom gave me the Lakota name, Sha'agyamani, He Walks Strong, is, I don't know if you were here for that, but for whatever reason, I've never gotten away from my salvation experience. I've never gotten away from, I'm Pentecostal, okay? People get healed and stuff happens, you know, and you can't explain that, and those experiences are something I'm indebted to, and I stay, as Native American, I feel like I stay true to my roots, and as a Christian, I'm going to stay true to my roots as well. And I've just never, ever, descriptively anyways, said, God is not a loving God. Christ didn't die for my sins. Christ, you know, like, I still have a Trinitarian faith, and it's not for any other reason than I'm compelled to have that. So, I don't know if that's a sufficient answer for you, but...
Well, let us slide today.
Okay.
I think that something, speaking to the idea of canonicity, is that it's important for me as a pastor to hold in tension, is the fact that the nature, and I think part of the beauty of the canon, is that it preserves this internal debate inside the scriptures that is ongoing. That it does not present, despite my earlier language about some of this text about the Canaanites being propaganda, it doesn't present only one side. It doesn't present just one narrative of propaganda. It presents a multiplicity. In other words, it's true that the Canaanites are portrayed, particularly in that section of the narrative, in a very harsh and negative light, and yet simultaneously, in the prophets, the strangers and the Canaanites are actually the source of Israel's salvation. And again, the prophets are calling Israel to recognize the holiness, the virtue, the nobility of the Canaanites as a form of judgment against Israel. Look and see that these people who don't have God are actually more virtuous, more righteous than you, Israel, again and again in the prophets. And there's another story, the one of the only times the word Canaanite is used in the New Testament is actually in reference to the Canaanite woman, or Syrophoenician woman if you're in another version, but the Canaanite woman coming to Jesus, and it's the lone example in the gospel narratives of a character engaging in a public discussion with Jesus, and Jesus conceding the point that the other person is right. In every other exchange, Jesus wins the argument. It's the sole instance in which Jesus says, "You're right, I concede." And it's in a discussion with the Canaanite woman, and so the canon as a whole isn't actually like monolithic in its portrayal of the Canaanites, and that sort of other narrative, that subversive narrative, the Canaanites are sometimes the instrument of God's grace and God's righteousness in the world. Is like actually a narrative that I would say that from a Christian perspective, looking from the New Testament, looking from Jesus, is actually the narrative that ultimately kind of is prioritized. That Jesus would basically ultimately say, you know, no, actually, the other narrative about the stranger, the other narrative about the Samaritan, that is the narrative that really truly speaks to God, mm-hmm. as opposed to the narrative about Joshua and conquest.
Yeah, but the problem is that Justice Marshall isn't reading the prophets when he.
That's right, right? Yeah. We want to put the Ten Commandments up, but we don't want to put up the Sermon on the Mount, right?
That's really interesting in how we employ the metaphor to justify horrendous action vis-a-vis the Western expansion of the United States. We'll employ the metaphor of the Canaanites, but we won't employ the metaphor of rebuke when it's the Canaanites who are the example of rebuke. And we won't employ the metaphor, as you said, brought up the Syrophoenician woman. No one's ever accuse Native Americans of being the Syrophoenician woman who speaks corrective authority to power, the ultimate power. This is Jesus.
Yeah.
And no one would be willing to employ that metaphor historically. But we have countless examples of employing the Canaanite metaphor for the westward conquest because they're just savages. They're the embodiment of chaos, is part of your thesis.
I'm going to call you a Canaanite woman. You have your wish.
Yes.
Let's go talk about a water fountain.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned you had some conversion experience at a summer camp, and I was wondering if you could share that with us. Or you want to keep it personal? Or...
No. It's I don't know if I tell it the same way as I did before, but
that's fine.
As you get older, different parts of it stand out. Mm-hmm. But you know, I was raised traditional Lakota Sioux up until the age of like 10, and then I started getting into just like not really caring about spirituality, not really caring, certainly not about Christianity. I would have described myself as an atheist when I gave my heart to the Lord. And what it was, I believe that it was the power of God. I don't even remember what the sermon was about, probably about salvation and about Jesus and about turning away from the world, and I was just overwhelmed with the idea of a God who gave his life for my sins, you know. And I thought it would be worth my time, it'd be worth my life to give back to that God. And so I would say now that, you know, it was the Holy Spirit that came over me and compelled me to go answer an altar call. And so I went up, and as I went up, you could just feel the overwhelming power of the Spirit, and it brought me to my knees right at the altar, and I cried and gave my heart to Jesus. And in an instant, my whole personality changed. I don't know how else to describe that experience, but you know God is involved, or at least you can safely, like, assume God is involved when something so dramatic like that happens. Your identity is reconstituted in a matter of seconds, and you don't want to be someone who goes around swearing and putting graffiti on things, or you know what I mean. But that's an event for me as a 14-year-old, is to shape up.
I was also wondering if, being in Dakota, if you ever encountered that book by Stoltzman, Christ in the Pipe.
Yeah, the Pipe and Christ
Dialogue.
Yeah, I started reading it, but it was really boring. Because he's talking about Catholics.
Yeah.
Vine Deloria Jr., great Sioux scholar and lawyer, wrote about the fundamental inadequacy of Christianity for Native American ways of thinking. And he goes down the list: Lutherans, Catholics, Episcopals, all of these ways of Presbyterians. But he says how there's not a single Christian denomination that Native Americans can really, where Native Americans can really identify with their worldview, except for Pentecostals. Like, he makes the one exception for Pentecostals. I'm not quite sure what you just asked me, but that was the thought that I had.
Question. I just wondered if you read into the book and what you thought of it.
Oh, yeah.
I was also wondering, too.
Because I was bored, and I was pondering why I was bored.
Yeah, drum groups, when they're singing, a lot of them will chew that one swamp plant, Sweet Flag. And I also noticed it's mentioned in the Old Testament, too, if you knew much about that. Or...
I'm sorry, no. I'm not sure they chew on a swamp plant.
Yeah, Calamus Sweet Flag. It's got a couple different names.
Oh, that's the name of the group?
No, the plant.
Bitter. The plant.
Yeah, works on their throats for singing.
Yeah, mm-mm. I haven't seen that in the Old Testament at all. Probably in Leviticus, so. Or maybe in Exodus. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
No, it's an ingredient in Moses' holy anointing oil.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
That's cool. I should look into that more.
All right, well, if there's nothing else, a big thank you to Edwin.
Yeah.